The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Okay. We're going to talk about persuasion. And I needed persuaded of something this week. We were down in Tasmania, and I heard what I considered to be blasphemy, that there was something called Tasmanian whiskey, and that 2 years ago, one of the Tasmanian whiskeys had won the Best Whiskey in the World award. And I refused to believe it. I really needed persuaded of it. So they said, look, we'll go to this cafe stroke distillery, which was fairly early in the evening, but it was closed. I said, yeah, I don't believe it. However, we did manage to go later on. And I do have to confess, it was absolutely outstanding whiskey. And I'm still traumatized and recovered from this. You could have left us with something. But how was I persuaded? Now, for me, it's the same thing when we're talking about Christianity. So most people are going to say, right, it's fine you being a Christian, but you're saying it's this, this, and this. I need to be persuaded of that. I need evidence. How do you persuade people? Now, most of you are lawyers, and your job is to persuade people, your client is innocent or your client is guilty, that the house they're about to buy is really worth double the cost that you're asking for it, or it's worth half the cost that your opponent is asking for it. So how do you actually persuade people? And this is not a kind of Paula White style, if you like. You know, here's 10 points on how you can become a better lawyer. But actually, you could apply these principles in terms of legal arguments as well. But I'm applying them in terms of being convinced about Christianity. Now, what we're looking at is this, Paul on trial before King Agrippa. And it's one of those things that if you're a Christian, for example, a lot of people just skim through this stuff. This isn't Romans 8. This is towards the end of the book of Acts, and it kind of seems to peter out because Acts starts with Pentecost and it finishes with Paul under house arrest in Rome, and that's it. There's no, and they lived happily ever after. There's no, and this is what happened. So these last chapters, apart from a very dramatic shipwreck, it doesn't appear to be much. But I think the more I look at this, the more wonderful this is. So just benefit of background. Apostle Paul is, he was known as Saul, he's a Jewish leader, religious leader, hates Christians, decides to basically kill them, persecute them, stamp them out because they're going to disrupt his religion. He becomes a Christian, and very unusually for someone of his background, instead of communicating what he now believes to his fellow Jews, he becomes what's called the apostle to the Gentiles. And in the days without air flight and so on, he basically travels the Mediterranean, and everywhere he goes, people become Christians, and in effect, the whole world is turned upside down, as we saw last week. He goes back to Jerusalem, and a riot is caused. He's arrested. Because he's a Roman citizen, he appeals to Caesar, which gives him an automatic right to be tried before Caesar. That was what all Roman citizens had. We don't know actually how he was a Roman citizen, probably because the city he's from, Tarsus, most of the people born there would have been regarded as Roman citizens. And so he has to be taken to Rome to go to court, and that's a six-month journey. And he's taken, first of all, to meet the Roman governor and the Jewish king in that area. And this is the scene of them in trial. And I'm just going to rush through it with some basic principles, I think, for persuasion, because this is what he does. Principle number one, if you want to learn something, admit you don't know. I think I told some of you this before. I have a friend who lectures in Singapore, Malaysia, and China, Hong Kong. And when he came back to Scotland, he said to me this. He said, David, the reason that the Chinese are going to dominate the world in the next century is because, he said, when I come to Scotland, the students ask me to hear what they know. They want to tell me what they know. When I'm in Malaysia or Singapore or Hong Kong, the students want to know what I know. If you want to learn, you admit what you do not know. And Here, Festus is saying, I have nothing to write to His Majesty about him. I don't know what to say about this guy. I don't know. Basically, he's calling in somebody else to help him. He has to write a letter to Caesar to explain why he's coming. So the first principle of anything is admit you don't know. And I also think in today's world, that's hard because in the age of Twitter and Google, everyone knows everything. It's really hard to admit you don't know something. I remember once doing a Q&A and somebody asked me something and I said, I don't know. And they thought it was a trick. They didn't think I really meant it. I thought, but David, you know everything. And I said, well, I'm sorry I give you that impression. You'd be amazed how much I do not know. And in fact, a level of wisdom is the more you grow and mature, the more you realize what you do not know. That is not saying it's impossible to know anything. It's just saying that when you know something, it helps you grasp how much you don't know. Second principle, get the main line of inquiry. They had some points of dispute about him, about their own religion, and a dead man named Jesus, whom Paul claimed was alive. And I find this astonishing when we're talking about Christianity. People will often want to talk about things that are relatively trivial. You know, so will you talk about this? Will you talk about this? Will you talk about that? I say, well, get the main point. What is the main point? And here he got it straight away. If Jesus is alive, a dead man named Jesus who he said was now alive, that changes everything. And that for me is absolutely crucial. I know people who say, you know, I'll go and say that, you know, I'm a Christian, I'm speaking somewhere and I'm talking about maybe, I don't know, science and Christianity. And the first thing that they'll say to me is, well, what about same-sex marriage? Or what about this? Or what about that? And whilst there are discussions and lots of interesting things you can get out of that, the first thing is you've got to get your core stuff right. And the main line of inquiry, if you're going to persuade people, make sure you're not wasting time arguing. Again, let me use social media as an example. How many times, well, you all look incredibly intelligent and mature people, so you won't have done this. But if you were like me, you get involved in a social media argument. People just shoot off onto other subjects all the time. And again, I think if you're a good lawyer, by the way, in court, you want to stick to the subject. You do not want to deviate from that. Number three, you ask questions. Then Agrippa said to Paul, you've permission to speak for yourself. So Paul motioned with his hand and began his defense. Now, here's the interesting thing. Agrippa and Festus, they're saying to Paul, you have got to tell us what your defense is. You genuinely ask questions. Now, there's a way of asking questions that's really annoying. Some of you who are parents will have been on the car journey, which the child, as soon as you drive out, are we nearly there yet? Which, if you're driving to Hobart, is quite difficult from Sydney. Are we nearly there yet? No, we've just begun. We've another 2 days to go or whatever. And, you know, or the child that says, well, why have you asked me to tidy my bedroom? And the way they go on, they end up with, you know, why does the universe exist? Just keeps going and going and going and going with questions. But I think asking questions, again, is a lost art. Often you'll notice this when questions are asked, they are asked in the form of accusations. So again, you'll know that if you're questioning someone in a court, are you asking a question to get information? Are you asking a question to trap them? Are you asking a question to accuse? And again, I think if you're going to examine Christianity, You've got to ask questions, intelligent questions. Number four, listen to others. King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against all the accusations of the Jews, and especially so because you're well acquainted with all the Jewish customs and controversies. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. Now, again, this is to do with personality type, but if you're the kind of personality whose purpose in life is to interject to anyone, to let them know what you know, to immediately answer what they're saying, listening patiently really helps. In fact, again, let me just say this to those of you who are Christians. If you're talking about wanting to share your faith, one of the first things, one of the primary things, is you learn to listen to others. You know where they're coming from. You know what they're doing. Listening helps enormously. Listen to the culture. Listen. Now, again, with Christianity, listen to the witnesses. Listen to people. Try and find out what is going on. Number five, examine the evidence. They have known me for a long time and can testify, if they're willing, that I conform to the strictest sect of our religion, living as a Pharisee. What Paul is saying is, I'm not just saying this. There are many witnesses who can testify about me that this is where I was at. So again, you need to look at the evidence. So let me go back to the whiskey thing I said at the beginning. I could argue till I was blue in the face about whiskey, and it would be a nationalistic pride thing, and I could give you lots of historical arguments and so on. But going and examining the evidence, which I'm very, very happy to do, if there are any disputes about whiskey, if you say a whiskey is better than another one, then let me examine the evidence. Give me a bottle of whatever you're saying, and I will spend my time happily examining your evidence. But you do. You examine, you look at, you test. I mean, I say this honestly, that I have been studying the Bible at a professional level, if you like, for about 35 years. I know it looks as though that means I was studying it coming out of my nappies, but I have been doing that. And yes, there have been times when I've looked at an issue and thought, that cannot be right. I cannot see that. You know, and I've had to be aware, I don't sit and judge upon the Bible or anything like that. But I would simply say that for me, examining the evidence, I'm confident enough to say to someone, go and examine the evidence and you'll see for yourself. Providing principle number 6, be logical. Paul, it's quite incredible. He stands up before them and says, why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? Well, of course it's incredible. So why is he saying? Because he's making a logical point. And here's the logical point. If there is an almighty God, then he could raise the dead. Now, the whole point is that if you believe that there isn't an almighty God, then that can't happen. And what I find with a lot of the more fundamentalist atheists, like Richard Dawkins, is that they start off with a presupposition, and they interpret everything with that presupposition. So there is no supernatural, therefore there can be no evidence of the supernatural. Whatever it means, there must be another explanation. But a logical point of view, G.K. Chesterton said this, believers in miracles believe because they have evidence. Those who don't believe in miracles believe because it's a doctrine. Don't believe because they have a doctrine. The doctrine is this cannot happen. Whereas if you were being logical, you would say, well, in theory, yes, it could happen, which is not the same as saying it did happen, but you could argue that it could happen. So what I'm trying to say is that if you're going to make a case for anything, you do need to be logical. And I realize, again, in the contemporary Christian church, I think the emphasis on logic and reason is fairly minimal. And I think that's wrong. Number 7, search the scriptures. God has helped me to this very day as I stand here and testify to small and great alike. I'm saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen, that the Messiah would suffer and as the first to rise from the dead would bring the message of light to his own people and to the Gentiles. Now, why is he doing that? Well, first of all, he's saying to Festus and also to Agrippa, you've read this, you know this. And it's interesting that they avoid his question and his logic. But I find it fascinating, again, that there are a significant number of people who will say, I don't believe the Bible, but they haven't read it. And here, I think, is where the advantage of something that City Bible Forum does called one-to-one works. And that is this. One-to-one is not, it's reading the Bible with somebody else, one-to-one. But it's not, now, you're going to read this and you have to believe this or else. It's read in order to examine with somebody else. And the reason for doing it with somebody else is so that you can interact, you can ask questions. You know, you've got a real-life person there. And I think it is important to search the scriptures. Now, I would apply that principle in various other things. So, for example, I think it's important for me in the work that I do to read the Quran. So I've read the Quran. I think it's important for me to read, you know, if I'm aware that people have beliefs in certain things, to find out what they are. So for a while ago, I was at a concert in which it was fairly clear that it was the Falun Gong sect. And it was absolutely amazing that what they projected and what they... And I thought, I got to find out about... So I read about Falun Gong. If you're going to think about something and make a judgment on something, surely you have to read it. Again, just from a legal perspective. If you're the prosecution and the defense has a case, if you don't read their case, you're not exactly going to be a very good lawyer. So you read both. Search the scriptures. Don't be too quick to dismiss. I think we're very dismissive. At this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defense. "You're out of your mind, Paul," he shouted. "Your great learning is driving you insane." And I find that also fascinating. Paul standing there. By the way, you'll notice what's happened. What's happened is Paul's turned the tables. He's on trial, but in reality, he's turned it the other way around. And you find that Festus's reaction is, "You know, you're crazy, man. And your great learning has driven you insane." There's no question about his intelligence, but your great learning has driven you mad. Very intelligent people can be driven insane, often are. I'm reading a book on the treatment of insanity in Australia in the 19th century. And it's absolutely fascinating in terms of its history. But we find that people can dismiss things very, very quickly. Now, obviously, there are some things that are immediately dismissible. The woman who says to you, "If you give $100,000, you'll get $1 million back." I'm sorry, if you even countenance that, you shouldn't be anywhere near the law, the legal trade, or the clergy, actually. But sometimes we just go, no, that cannot be right. And I'm sorry for coming back to the whiskey analogy, but it has traumatized me. I'm just saying, someone said to me, "Oh, it's won the best whiskey in the world." I said, no, it won the best whiskey in Australia, and that's not a high bar. You know, and then, okay, I shouldn't have dismissed it. You know, when I tasted it, it was quite spectacular. Don't be too quick to dismiss. Don't avoid the question. Agrippa said to Paul, "Do you think in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian?" Now, what's happening here? Oops, go back. Oh, no. I need to go back one. There you are. What is he doing? He's deflecting. Paul has just said to Agrippa, "You know the scriptures. You know what happens. Come on. Put two and two together." And so what he's doing is he's saying, "Do you think you're going to persuade me to be a Christian in this short time?" He's deflecting. He's avoiding the question. Some of us are too clever by half. We're always sitting in judgment. We're always waiting for evidence. We don't come to a point where we make a decision, which is the last point. I've called it act, believe, and close. Agrippa said to Festus, "This man could have been set free if he'd not appealed to Caesar." See, what they did was they went away and they talked about the messenger. They didn't talk about the message. And they avoided the question. The thing is, at some point, this kind of question about Christianity, at some point, you've got to act on it. It's like getting married. Well, a good friend just got married at the weekend. And I remember him coming and talking to me about proposing and everything else. At some point, they had to decide to do it and commit to one another. And you get to a point where you say, "I've got enough evidence. I'm going to believe. I'm going to act. I'm going to commit." And that's why closure is when your case is closed. Closure on an issue for me is when you, in a Christian sense, is when you say, "That's enough. I've got enough. I'm going to commit to follow Jesus Christ." Actually, it's not closure because it opens the door to a whole new life. But that's another subject. So let's leave it there. Thank you. Well, I met you lot and I want to understand you. No. I'm only kind of partially joking because actually the legal system and how it was done. Also, I'm a historian. I love history. And I wanted to learn about Australia. And for me, it was the best history is the one that's detailed. And this was really, really detailed. You know, I can't remember what it was. Madness in Botany Bay, I think it was called. Absolutely brilliant book, by the way. The second best book I've read about Australia. The first was one called The Bible in Australia, which has just won the award for the best book overall written in the past couple of years. So, but I just thought it was fascinating how people treated insanity. And by the way, if you were really, really bad, you were expelled here as a convict from the United Kingdom and you didn't behave, guess where they sent you? Hobart or Brisbane, which I thought was lovely. So the next time I go to Hobart and Brisbane, I'm going to say how glad I am to come out to the penal part of Australia. See how that one goes. Is Allah the same as God? In Arabic, yes. In Arabic, the term Allah means God. And in the sense of an almighty creator and so on, yes. But if you mean by Allah the Quranic description of God, the answer is no, because the fundamental of Christianity is that God is triune, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The other interesting thing about the Muslim doctrine of God is that there are 99 names for Allah, but not one of them is love. which I find completely fascinating. And the other thing as well is Allah is totally impersonal and beyond any kind of scrutiny and examination. What I've just said to you just now would, for a Muslim, not make any sense. You cannot know the unknowable. You cannot examine the unexaminable. And I think that that's a major difficulty. We'll just shoot through some of these. Many times when I've sought to share honestly about struggles in life, Christians in particular interject quickly with advice, counsel, Bible verses or prayer, or they just seem uncomfortable in hearing people out or sitting in weakness, their own or others. Any comment on this? Yes and no. No, I can't comment on your particular circumstances. Sometimes there are people who will, they just always want to tell you about themselves and what's going on. But in reality, I sympathize with this question a lot because when you go up to someone and say, how are you? The last thing you expect is an honest answer. I suggest you say to them, I'm fine, which stands for frustrated, insecure, neurotic, and exhausted. Then they will never ask you again. The reason I empathize with this question is I think we are far too quick, especially those who are Christians, to offer simplistic solutions to complex problems. And there is nobody more complex than you or me. You know, the heart is deceitful, says Jeremiah, in a thousand different ways. And we are messed up people living in a messed up society. And I think we should be much more careful listening to people before we give them soundbite answers. So it's a good question. Should we be listening more to children and drunks? I was in a toilet in the island of Lewis in a place called Stornoway one time. And this could only happen there. It's a very Calvinistic place. And a drunk came up to me and said to me, a complete stranger, what do you think about predestination? Never discuss predestination in a toilet with a drunk. That's all I'm saying. people who are drunk, what do you mean by drunks? I mean, they're people. People who are drunk, it's hard to have a sensible conversation with someone who's drunk. Just help them to sober up. Talk to them when they're sober. Should be listening more to children. Yes and no. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to let a 16-year-old Swedish girl tell me about climate change. I'm going to listen to some scientists and things like that. Of course you should listen to children because, you can learn from them, but two, you need to understand them. But, yeah, I love listening to children. What's the key to being a good conversationalist? Okay, I've just said it. Listening. And also, being well-read. And also responding to what people have said, not what you wish they have said. And also, maybe not talking about yourself. How can you persuade someone who doesn't want to be persuaded? You can't. But you can sow seeds in their minds that make them question their own beliefs. Most people don't want to be persuaded. For me, from the Christianity point of view, I knew all the arguments against Christianity and I probably could have destroyed most Christians in an argument. What really shook my world was meeting Christians who really lived it. And I just thought, I don't know how to cope with this. And I thought, maybe they're right. Maybe I ought to examine it. Maybe I ought to read the Bible. And that's what I started doing. I think it's, do you think you can persuade me? Well, you know what Paul does? He says, well, I wish that you were like me except for my chains. I can't persuade you. That's going to be up to God. Sometimes Christians have to be prepared to let things go. Your job is not to seal the deal. You can't, sell someone Jesus and you can't convert someone. The Holy Spirit does that. But if you believe it's the truth and that the truth will out, share what you can. There's a lot more to be said on that one, and I'd love to go into that one in more detail, but I realize people do have to go. The Israelites find all the evidence of God from Egypt, but still continue to fall into unbelief. How much evidence do we need to persuade people? At some point, do you think they have to experience the Holy Spirit? Yes, of course. We will always find reasons to disbelieve. I'm sure that many of you have experienced situations, even in court, where the person really, really does not believe what has actually happened. They persuaded themselves, and there's nothing you can say. If you've ever argued with a conspiracy theorist, you know what I mean. If you argue with a conspiracy theorist, everything you say will be immediately put as, well, that's because it's part of the conspiracy, isn't it? You just can't get around it. Did Paul actually fail miserably to persuade both King Agrippa and Festus because of the outcomes? No, because he was there to bear witness. God had promised him, you will bear witness before me, before kings. And that's what he did. He went to Caesar. He went to King Agrippa. He went to Festus. This small Jewish man who wasn't a good speaker got to testify about Jesus. And ultimately, what happened? Ultimately, the whole Roman Empire became more or less converted. Festus interrupted and said Paul was mad. Well, in that case, I'm phenomenally successful or a phenomenal failure because I've often been told I'm mad. Agrippa interrupted to suggest Paul was not going to persuade him to be a Christian. That's a sign it's working. When people are silent, you ain't getting anywhere. When they react, you're getting somewhere. It is an example. How do you evaluate those who once converted to Christianity but eventually changed their faith and converted to other religion like Jehovah's Witnesses? Can we regard this kind of people as committed Christians? No. No. Because to me, well, particularly with the Jehovah's Witnesses, it's like going from Tasmanian malt to blended whiskey or even to Coca-Cola. You know, you've tasted the best. Why would you go back to something that's not? And the problem with the Jehovah's Witness thing, by the way, is it is incredibly religious and incredibly cult-like. So that's why Jehovah's Witnesses don't knock on doors anymore. You just see them outside stations standing there, you know, as if you're going to go walk up to them and so on. I think you look at the evidence. Now, there are reasons people change. And often it's to do with experience, it's to do with groups, it's to do with many different things. There are reasons people profess to be Christian who are not Christian. So there are all kinds of things going on there. Personally, I know this is a strange thing, but I find religion quite dangerous. And if it was religion without Christ, personally, I'd rather be an atheist. But with Christ, I think that changes absolutely everything. I think if you're a committed Christian, you can fall away, you can do lots of different things, but at the end of the day, God's Spirit is within you. And I've seen many, many Christians who've turned away, but who've also been turned back. In fact, I once had a congregation that was more or less full of people like that. All right, that's all the questions. I think you do have to go to work. Thank you so much for your kindness in allowing me to be here and for your patience in listening. I am around, so if any of you ever want to meet up, please feel free. I'm now beginning to fulfill part of my mission to discover all the coffee shops in the CBD, but I'm sure some of you can enlighten me as to the better ones as well. May God bless you. Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.